Well, when I was first elected, West Virginia's school system was probably recognized by many people in the country as sort of being one of the worst. And we knew that education was the future of our state, and I believe the future of the country. I don't think there's a question that we're the leader in the country in using technology in education. We started with a basic skills program that we started in kindergarten, and we now are going into the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And I think it's had a huge impact on our school system, which I would say probably is the most improved school system in the country today.
West Virginia Governor Gaston Caperton. He's here to talk about information technology and leadership in American education. Welcome to Soundings, a cultural affairs radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, created in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. Later on the show this week, you'll also hear from telecommunications policy expert Sally Johnstone. Patterns of life, pathways of innovation. As descriptive themes for this year's Computer World Smithsonian Awards, those phrases invite us to understand how we change and to change how we understand. They're particularly apt in thinking about the nexus of information technology and American education, a cyberscape that changes almost daily for millions of students. But the meeting ground for computers and classrooms isn't science fiction or wishful thinking. For example, under the leadership of Governor Gaston Caperton, West Virginia, a state historically not known for educational innovation, has transformed itself. Since 1990, nearly 16,000 student computer workstations have been installed in classrooms ranging from kindergarten through grade 4. More than 10,000 teachers have benefited from hands-on training. I spoke to Governor Caperton during the Computer World Smithsonian Awards program, where he received the Zenith Data Systems Information Technology Leadership Award for Education.
Well, first of all, I think if you think of it as a tool and not a silver bullet, I mean, it is only one aspect of teaching. And obviously, a teacher has to play a very important role in this. But when I first really realized the strength of this was I was in a lab one day. This has been 8 years ago, and there were about five kids on one side of the room and five on the other. Five were on the computer and five were over there doing work. And there was a clock like you use in the kitchen that dings when it's time to take the water off the stove. This clock dinged. The five kids that were off the computers almost knocked me off getting across, knocked me down getting on the other side, to pull the kids that were on the computer off and say, "This is my turn, this is my turn." That kind of hunger for learning was really contagious. So there's just some things that you can do. I'm dyslexic. For example, very few students that now learn to, and I don't know the reason for this, who learn to these fundamentals of reading, writing, arithmetic on computers, somehow dyslexia doesn't seem to be nearly as prevalent. And in many cases, people say it really erases it. But I think that that the computer is very empowering. It gives the child the chance to move ahead as quickly as they want to move, or to go as slowly as they want to move. It can back up and support the teacher in what they're doing. If you have a classroom of, say, 20 students or 21 students, and you have four computers in the classroom where we have most of our computers, they can have as many as 8 students can be on the computer. Now the teacher has about a third as many students that she's teaching, so it's almost like a teacher's aide. So that's another advantage of it. But the test scores that we have in West Virginia, there's a fourth grade reading test that's given across the country, and we were always sort of at the bottom of the list on these kinds of things. Now we're judged among 15 southern states. We were second, barely behind North Carolina in reading. And the country, we're 19th on this test. That's a huge gain for us. So we know that, number one, it's shown up on test scores. Number two, it shows up in just plain enthusiasm and motivation about the students. And likewise, the teachers and the parents. I'll tell you one more story, which I think maybe says it better than any of them. Our superintendent of schools was in a rather rural area where coal mining has been an important part of that economy. Coal miners today are paid well. They're paid $40,000 to $50,000 a year. And this older man came up to the superintendent. He says, "You know, I've got no education, and I've got a good job. I'm a coal miner." He said, "My son has no education. He got a good job. He's a coal miner." But he said, "My grandson is in this grammar school. And," he said, "I want to thank you for the computers, because he has to learn how to use this technology if he's going to have a good job in the future." So parents understand where we're going. And it's given us a whole lift to go from a state that was probably, many thought, one of the more illiterate to one of the most computer literate. What a jump we've made doing that.
Governor Caperton, the word partnership looms large in the vocabulary of this these festivities that were involved in the Computer World Smithsonian Awards program. How do you convince the business types? You say you came out of a business background. How do you convince them to, they got to keep the eye on the bottom line, but how do you convince them to glance occasionally off over here into these educational enterprises so that sure, they're doing something good for the community, but they're also genuinely participating in the education of our kids?
Well, you know, I find the business community is very anxious to participate, but they've got to be asked. They have to be, like everybody else, motivated. They have to feel rewarded. And I was one of the founders with some other people of what was known as the West Virginia Education Foundation, which was the first private foundation to help public schools in the country. And we started a partnership for education where we basically have every school adopted by a business partner. And that's made a difference. We got Bell Atlantic, IBM, and General Motors to help us put together a program which we call our Center for Professional Development, which we put 16,000 of our 24,000 teachers through, which is a week-long course that was the same kind of professional training that you would give an executive with IBM or Bell Atlantic or General Motors. And we bring them in, we teach them very much like professional, we teach them the latest technology. So that's another partnership that was working. But I think we've only begun to scratch the surface. And there's two things that I'm really interested in the future. One is that I think we've got to get people into real mentoring programs into our school system. And I think those have to be sponsored by organizations, and I think it has to be done in the school. The second thing is that I think that if we really are going to have our schools in America be world-class and the best in the world, which if we have the best schools means that our people are going to have the best jobs and are going to have the highest standard of living. If we have a lousy school system, people are going to have to compete with their backs and not their brains, and our standard of living will fall behind. I think to do that, we've got to create a system like we built the interstate highway system. The interstate highway system had a huge amount to do with the economic growth in this country in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and still has a major impact. It meant people could get to work and live further distances away, that you could transport goods and equipment wherever you wanted to do, that it was safer. It put people to work with construction jobs. I mean, it just basically moved our economy ahead, as I say, in the 50s and 60s. Now, this is a time of technology. And I think that we have in West Virginia, which we do it better than anybody, but we need to do a whole lot more than we're doing. We're just beginning to scratch the surface. And I think that we need to have a program where the federal government matches us on a 50-50 basis, states, on how to use technology in education. And that we need to set some high standards of what that means, as they set high standards for how we built these highways. So I think you'd see states begin to invest in this technology in their education. It would be a thing that would infect the education system in such a powerful way that I think we would, without question, move our system way ahead.
Governor Caperton, we're talking about information technology, computers, and what you are, what you hope to accomplish, and what indeed you have accomplished in West Virginia. You are, as a matter of fact, the 1996 Zenith Data Systems Leadership Award winner for education. At the same time that we're talking about education, I noticed that here in the packet that the Zenith people gave out to all these participants is a bookmark. I mean, and that's stick in the mud, Governor. That takes us back to a technology that is dates from, what, the Middle Ages. How do we make the transition between the things that we're accustomed to and that we know and all of this wonderful whiz-bang gadgetry of the future?
Well, first of all, I don't think that there's... I don't see those things as competing. I read a tremendous amount and try to spend as much time as I can reading. I spend very little time on a computer in the job that I have. I don't think that one is exclusive of the other. The kind of information that you can get from a computer and the more availability of it, I still don't believe that I'm going to ever want to sit down and read a book off a screen. There's something I have a great love for books, and when I finish a book, I want to put it on my shelf and save it. It's books are something that I love, and I think I always will love books. And I don't see that this is, that technology is a competition towards books. I don't think any more than fiction is competition with biographies. I think that they all fit together, and that we want to, you know, we want to use all the ways we can learn and enjoy the process of learning.
Governor, do you think that in sort of the worst case scenario, do you think that we're headed toward a replication of the haves and the have-nots that we see in so many quarters of the American economy when we talk about computers? That is to say, the kids who have the initiative, who've got the hardware and software, they've got the good teachers, and then on the other hand, the kids who kind of get left behind. Here we're in, not to technology, we're into theology. We're dealing with some really deep-seated cultural questions. How do you get around, how do you come to issues like that?
Well, one of the real motivations that I had in this program for West Virginia was because I thought it brought real equality to our school system. That in a state which is very rural, that I wanted young people to have an opportunity to know what was going on in the rest of the world. I'll tell you just a quick story. One of the first model schools we did with the internet was in a place called Chapmansville in Logan County, West Virginia. Economy that has been based upon coal mining for a long time, and a fairly small community. I went in to see the internet, and the teacher, who was a social science teacher, said to me, "This is the most excited I've ever been in teaching. I'd like to take you upstairs and show you these young people on the internet." These were 12 and 13 year olds. One little boy looked like we were on the internet, looked like you were in a helicopter flying over Paris. And I said, "What's that?" And he said, That's the Louvre, and what is that? And he said, "That's Notre Dame." Knew all about Paris. I went over next, the young woman was on the internet, was on the email, and she'd already found a boyfriend in Paris, and she was corresponding with him. Then there were three young women who were learning Japanese from a teacher over television, over distance learning, from a teacher in Nebraska. Now, these young people, 2 years before, would have thought that a big trip would have been to come to Charleston, the capital of West Virginia. Now they're in Paris. Now they're learning Japanese. So if you use this technology in the right way, you open up the world to people, no matter what community they live in, whether they're rich or poor, whether they're urban or rural. But what you want to be sure is that you, number one, distribute this technology in an even way. And I think number two is that you've got to spend a whole lot of time and money training and motivating teachers to use it. And I think that it can result very much in a matter of haves and have-nots, but only if it's unfairly distributed. And I think that if you look back at America and look back at its growth and its strength, it was probably more than anything else because we were the first real nation that I'm aware of, modern nation, that came with a education system that was universal, free for everyone. And that is probably had more to do with the growth and expansion and development of America than anything else. I think we got with our affluence that we began to neglect our education system and didn't pay the attention to it that we needed to. And I think, A Nation at Risk was written some 10 years ago now. And it sort of brought that to our attention, that we really have to do something about this education system. I happen to believe that technology is one of those things that we can infect the system with, that can make it come alive, jump us over those places where they're not doing, can add energy and excitement to it, and that it can make a huge difference in what is the future of our country, which is the education of our young people.
When you look to the future, Governor, and you have such high hopes, what keeps you awake at night? What do you worry about? You know, is there a single kind of obstacle that you think, if we could just crack this nut, then to mix the metaphor, the dam will burst here. How do you react to that?
Well, you know, I think that there's nothing that makes me sadder than to walk into a school where I see young people not excited about learning, who are just sort of going through the motions, where there is administration and teachers who don't seem very, just have a job and not an occupation, not a calling. And you recognize what a damaging thing that is to those human beings. That the thing that motivates me the most is trying to do things that can allow people to reach their potential and to see their possibilities. And so what really worries me are things like drugs, which are a huge deterrent to young people's opportunity to grow. Children who are not getting the nurturing that they need. Particularly, we know more and more today that the brain develops and grows at such an early age, even sort of prenatal, and certainly in those first couple of years, and that not only intellectually but emotionally, and that we're not paying enough attention to that, that we have neglected our children and aren't giving them the real opportunity in life we want to give them. My dad always told me that, my mom too, that the American dream was not about what we did, but it's what we did for our kids. And so I guess the thing that keeps me awake the most at night is to think that we're probably not doing, that I see and understand that we're not doing enough for our children. And that means all of our children. That means the children that haven't had the advantages are the ones we have to work oftentimes the hardest with. Because we are a community, we are one, and we can be no better than those who have the least.
Gaston Caperton is governor of West Virginia. During recent ceremonies in Washington, D.C. at the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, Governor Caperton received this year's Zenith Data Systems Information Technology Leadership Award for Education. You're listening to Soundings, a cultural affairs radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Information Technology and American Education will continue in just a moment. I'll talk with Sally Johnstone, Executive Director of the Western Cooperative for Educational Telecommunications.
I would suggest that we've come quite a ways. 7 years ago when our organization was founded, people would say, oh, what do you do? And I would say, oh, I had this telecommunications cooperative in the Western states. And they'd go, what? Now I mention that phrase and they go, oh, really? That's very interesting. So you're working with computers and you're working with links and yes, you know, obviously. And I think that the notion of public awareness and public expectation that there are things going on technologically that should also be going on in our schools and in our universities to assist students to move forward in a new way of doing things is the biggest battle.
Sally Johnstone is Executive Director of the Western Cooperative for Educational Telecommunications.
States, as you know, have traditionally had the responsibility for, let's call it consumer protection of the students in their states. And that's not a bad role, but the difficulty is that that was based on states examining and licensing every institution within the states, and now students are studying electronically from faculty in another state, from another country, wherever. And the states don't know quite how to deal with this in a policy framework. So we developed a project that's really based on the 15 Western states and put together a set of principles of good practice that many of those states have already adopted and others are looking at and figuring out how to adopt, to in essence have a common groundwork of what constitutes quality and consumer protection in this new electronic learning environment, so that we can in effect have the states informing students, maybe not controlling institutions, but informing students and helping them understand how to evaluate whether an educational product that's being offered to them is in fact a valid one.
You're talking about the content of the course or the way it gets delivered electronically across these boundaries?
It's primarily the content and the credential that a student earns as a result of going through the learning experience. The range of technologies that are currently out there and are being used very effectively is enormous. There is no one way to do this well technologically. There are many, many innovative and interesting ways to do it well. But the critical aspect of this is how well supported the student is, how well the institution knows how to literally create good quality learning environments, and whether or not the credential that the student gets for, in terms of the bang for their buck, is actually valid.
Sally, why is it that we have to have more regulation? This is America. We compete. It's a marketplace. Isn't that one of the, at least from part of our political spectrum, that seems to be the watchword?
That's an extremely good point. And I think what the project that I've just described is a transition. We're moving from an environment in which regulation is the way we've done business in this particular world. And it's a little tough to just drop that completely, both in terms of the responsibilities that the states see, also in terms of the expectations of the public. So I think what we're trying to do is level that a little bit and create an interim step that will eventually empower the consumer so that the marketplace, if we want to call it that, really does become the driving force, but it needs to be an informed consumer and a consumer that understands there is a certain set of questions that he or she is entitled to have good answers to. And right now, there's very little awareness of what those questions are. So that's what we're trying to move toward.
Do you point to particular institutions or groups of institutions in the Western states and you say, these are models for the kind of people and schools, institutions that are providing the leadership for these, again, beneficial changes in policy that you are seeking to institute?
There are a number of them, and they're in little pockets, and they're doing things in different ways. I think a number of the campuses within the California State University system have begun to shift in new ways. Some have not. Washington State University has a very innovative president that is saying, we need to rethink how our campus operates because we want to be able to serve our students locally as well as around the state just as effectively electronically.
Sally, in a nutshell, what would be your highest hope for the kind of policy changes that you want to implement? And what's your deepest fear? What keeps you awake at night?
Well, the way we're pulling this together, I think, is both my deepest fear and my great ambition, and that is the Western governors have proposed a new institution, which is they're calling the virtual university, and I think its current name is the Western Governors University. And it is really designed to bypass all of the difficulties that we find with institutional policies, with state policies, and maybe to push some of the issues in federal policies that will enable students to be treated a little bit more like consumers in the sense that they will be able to have access to a wide range of educational opportunities and not have to worry about whether or not their home institution can transfer these in, whether or not the schedule is such that their lives fit with it. And it's a way of pulling it all together. And in terms of both keeping me awake at night and also being exciting, trying to design this, which is what we're doing right now with the political force of many of the Western governors behind it, is a very scary proposition. And our design is based on what we know works and what we know that doesn't seem to work in this new electronic era. And I really do think it is the next step for higher education anyway, moving into cyberspace.
Sally Johnstone directs the Western Cooperative for Educational Telecommunications. She was part of a panel discussion on achieving educational excellence at the 1996 Computer World Smithsonian Education Symposium in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Soundings, a cultural affairs radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, created in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefits society. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Audio tapes are available for $10 post-paid. Please write to us for a tape or with your comments. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 835. That's $10, program number 835. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. If you want more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. The telephone number is area code 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. The National Humanities Center is an independent nonprofit institute that seeks to encourage excellence in scholarship, to strengthen teaching, and to broaden public understanding of the humanities. Next week on Soundings, Remembering FDR, in recognition of Roosevelt History Month, the first to be so named in the nation's history, listen for one of America's distinguished historians and presidential scholars. William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill will be here to talk about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his life and legacy. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center.